lucky with front row cheerleaders. That's super cool. I was in an eighth grade class today at what school is he?
Mount Vernon Christian.
What grade are you in?
Yeah.
Okay, so I just missed you by one grade, seventh grader. Mr. Something
on the baby left.
Well, I feel really grateful that I can be here and be a part of the conversation you're having about faith and being in. And I met Jim, I think it was a couple months ago, at a little event that I spoke at. And I enjoyed our talk, and it turned into me being invited here tonight and joining you tomorrow for a short talk in the Sunday service too. And I feel lucky because I get to come in and meet you, and I get to come in and be a part of, I think, the most important conversation the world is having. And that's the conversation about faith, what it looks like, what it acts like, how it breathes, how it speaks. So, I grew up in Fairbanks, Alaska. I gave my life to Christ 9 days before I turned 18, after a particularly heavy LSD trip. And since I was a little boy, I was looking for God. And the culmination of events that came to fruition on March 19th meant that I asked Jesus to take over the mess I had made of my life and make something cool out of it and restore me. And I became really good friends with a guy who was from a similar background as me. And I prayed with that guy a lot and studied the Bible with him. And he invited me to a Thailand to study Thai. I could see where I went. The idea was I'd study Thai for a year. And so, he sent me to this thing called YWAM, Youth Commission. I went through an ETS in 1987. And my outreach was in Japan, which is where I met this fiery, orange-haired Norwegian girl. We were runners, and we just went running together. But 3 years later, it turned into more than running. And I asked this one. So we've been married for 29 years this year.
Awesome.
Got three daughters. Elisa's 23, Naomi's 21, and Kristen's 17. I helped start a couple of churches. I worked in a church for a couple of years. Do you guys know that? The non-denomination called Calvary Chapel.
Yeah.
They say they're not a denomination, but if you're not preacher and pastor, you can't join. So. I was in the name of those guys and worked with church for a couple of years. And then my wife and I went back to Thailand and started a student center. And in 1994, I hiked into a refugee camp to preach the gospel. And in 1994, I thought the gospel was this verse. That the gospel essentially is the propositions of Christ, that we are invited to believe these things about Jesus. When we do, our allegiance or our citizenship in hell is transferred from darkness to light, and we're on our way to heaven. We pray these things and we are saved. This is our language, right? How do you understand? So, for me, that was kind of where it started and ended. I felt like and understood my job to be telling that story, the propositions of Jesus, and inviting people to believe them. And once they believe them, that I have done my job. In fact, the summer that I lived in Japan and worked with my wife's team, they were starting a church, I left 32 children in a prayer of faith on the streets of just outside of Tokyo. I felt pretty good about myself. And all of my experience up until 1994 had to do with the idea that I was an evangelist. And by whatever means I used, I was looking for the opportunity to get those propositions out there and invite people to give their life to Christ. Now, there's obviously a place for that. Paul spends a lot of time writing about it, right? And it is a part of what we are and who we are. But what I learned from a woman, a widow, who had been raped and tortured for 9 months and who had a tremendous story of redemption, what I learned from her is that if that's all it is, then it's part of the problem. If it's only about our words, this thing we call the gospel may not be good news. I mean, in some situations, it can be very bad news. We objectify a person, turn them into a target. I mean, Muslims see right through that. Boom, they see it really fast. Yeah, we know what you're going to do. You're going to do a development project, and then you're going to invite our children to a summer program, and then you're going to ask them to raise their hands and pray. And some of them are going to do that, and you're going to hope that those children lead us to Christ. We've heard this from our Muslim friends. Objectifying people, turning them into a target, that's like easy to see, right? You can see that, okay? What about in the case of trauma? A child who's been sexually violated, a 5-year-old, 6-year-old. That child is in a state of dysfunction. Is that the best time to get them to say that prayer after you? How about people who are running for their lives? Refugees, these people that we met in 1994, their stories unraveled me. Rose herself, that lady right there, and those orphans in front of her. Oh, I remember this little girl. She was so... Do you see that face? I remember her too. I think this is picture was taken around 1995. And so we walked into this refugee camp in 1994, and we're following Eliezer, 49th grandchild of Molly Moon, committed Christian elders in this refugee camp. And Eliezer is studying medicine to be a nurse, and as we walk into the camp, she's pointing stuff out to us. You know, the guy who's sitting on his porch with a handmade or homemade prosthetic leg, and he's wearing dark sunglasses, and it looked funny to me. He had scars all over his face. So I said, Eliezer, who's this guy? What happened? Why is he wearing sunglasses? And she said, oh, there's many people just like him in our camp, this camp of 9,000, Shogo refugee camp. And it's because when their villages are destroyed, when the Burma army attacks their village, and they run, landmines have been set so that it would maim or kill these people as they're running. They set them intentionally on exit or entrance points in the village. And so as they're running, they step on a landmine, and it's common that they step on something, detecting something down there. They look down, and the blast blows their face up, and, you know, blows their leg, mangles their leg, and if they are lucky enough to live, they end up like that guy, either blind in one or both eyes, losing their eyes, and then having shrapnel fill their face and their front part of their torso, and then ending up usually with the prosthetic on the leg. So she explained that to me. I'd never heard that story before. And then, you know, she talked about depression and trauma and what these people are going through. And then I asked her, you know, why are all these kids, there's like hundreds of little kids running around all the time. And it's in the dirt, and these are bamboo huts that they live in that were built to last for rainy season. And they've lived in them for like 8 years. So I said, why are these kids only wearing t-shirts and no underwear, boys and girls, you know, up to probably 9 years old? And then they have lesions on their head and lesions on their arms, lesions on their, they have lesions everywhere. They all are dripping nose and everything like this, you know, sick. And, but they're happy, they're running around like kids anywhere. That's what kids do, you know, even if it's hell on earth. And so she said, and I, but I said, why are their tummies sticking out? It didn't make sense to me. She told me they were malnourished. And some of them are protein malnourished. And if you know what that, have you seen that before? Protein malnourished children, you know, you look at a child and you say, that child's head looks like she's a 13-year-old, but her body looks like a 6-year-old. That's because the skull and cartilage in your head grows at a regular rate, even if protein is insufficient for the rest of your limbs to grow. And there will even be kids with irregularly shaped arms, you know, one longer than another. That's long-term protein malnourishment. So I said, well, if they're malnourished, why are their tummies sticking out? They look fat to me. She said it's because of parasites. Parasites fill their tummies because when they've run from their village, their whole hygiene routine is upset. They're not boiling their water anymore because they're on the run trying to avoid contact with the Burma army. They don't have any shelter. I mean, they're just in a survival mode. And so they're drinking, you know, impure water, and even their food is not prepared properly. And then all the other routines of hygiene are down the drain with it. And these parasites grow, their worms, they grow and they consume the stomach cavity, which causes not just the loss of protein and nutrients from the food that they do get, but also it causes bloating. And that's what that is. It's like, wow, I had no idea. So I said, Eliezer, what's it cost to take the bloating away? I mean, how do we kill the worms? And she said, albendazole.
Mm-hmm.
What's albendazole? And she said, it's the two-pill regimen that gives a three-month window of purity, even in a state of you're probably a nurse, hygienic.
No, we've had to use it.
Okay, well, that's a regular thing we use too, right?
I've been
for 25 years, did I tell you that?
Let that part out.
So, I just thought it was pretty cool that in Thai, Thai, come then, bawaha, harum, yin come. So one word can mean five things in Thai, and the kids thought it was really cool that the word cow can be cow, 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 cow. So that means white, rice, enter, news. And mountain. Did I say mountain?
No.
Okay. So all five of those things with one word. And so that's a whole other story about that. So with these refugees, and I understand. So I said, Eliezer, how much does it cost to kill the parasites? And she said, the equivalent of 25 cents. And I said, that would be really great news if I was the dad, you know, of these kids, and my kids are in this perpetual state of malnourishment, and to spend a quarter so these kids don't have to, you know, deal with these worms and the loss of nutrients, and there's all kinds of long-term consequences to protein malnourishment. I mean, they don't have the biochemical action going on in their brains either. They're not developing like they should. 25 cents. It's like, whoa, man, that's... And actually, I had a theology back then. I had a theological paradigm, so to say, that this is all that matters. That's it. Anything else could conflict. It could confuse the motives. You know, have you all heard of Rice Christians, social gospel, heard of this stuff? So you mix these mechanisms together, and then you don't know if they're actually praying because they want a relationship with God or if they're praying because maybe you're desperate to have some food. And so I decided in my ministry work that I wouldn't ever do it. I wouldn't help people because my job is to get people from hell to heaven. That's how I saw it. Well, I got into this camp, and there's another thing. Like, half of the people in the camp are Christians. And that kind of blew my mind, too, because they're super faithful Christians. They pray all night, and they do all the right stuff. They're incredible. Like, just amazing believers. And the reward for their faithfulness is what happened to Rose? And this lady, Rose, she came from a wealthy Rangoon family. Her husband was a veterinarian and he was studying medicine, and they went to start the first clinic in that camp so that that these people would suffer less. And they sacrificed. They left their home and their wealth, cashed in to be missionaries. And when Rose went home to visit, you know what her crime was when they put her in prison? She helped missionaries. She helped refugees. Refugees was anti-government. The people that they're trying to kill, she was helping, and so they put her in prison. And her husband wanted her to get out, of course. And so he cashed in all his social economy, all his relationships, all their contacts, spent all his money trying to get his wife out of prison. It's a corrupt country. It's a military regime. It's a dictatorship at the time. I would beg to say it still is. But he couldn't get her out. One of his colleagues administered an anti-anxiety drug, an injection. It was diazepam, Valium. And it was too high of a dose, his heart stopped, and he died.
Oh.
3 weeks later, Rose got out of prison and walked. Now, not only, she's been through hell on earth, and not only have they sacrificed tremendously in the name of faith in order to serve suffering people, but now she doesn't have a passport. She is a refugee. And she hikes to the Moy River, the natural boundary between Thailand and Burma, crosses the river, and comes into Shobo camp, expecting to be reunited with her husband, and just to find that he had just been buried, and her neighbors were caring for her two young children. So when I, when I heard her story, and when I interacted with these people, It confronted me. I didn't know. I felt that to just do what I always did, to lead them to Christ. Half of them are Christians, half aren't. They're animists or they're Buddhists. And I could have lots of work just, doing what I did before. But something felt wrong. Something felt, I felt like I was missing the plot. Part of that was this lady. Because this lady had been through the story I just told you, but she was the happiest lady I'd ever met and had incredible dignity. She swept the dirt off her dirt so that her entryway to her bamboo hut was clean. She planted flowers and old munitions casings and cans and plastic bottles. Nobody does that. I mean, at least not back then, not in the refugee camp. There's not a whole lot of colorful hope floating around in this refugee camp. You go to Rose's house, that's what it was. And then there was this constant buzz of kids because any child that was falling through the crack, she found that child and brought them to her home, and she had a day program. She's a teacher, educated teacher, by the way. She had a day program for them. And when she told me this, her story and how she applied her faith, I was pretty shook up because I thought, this lady has something I don't have, and this lady actually cares about people. Like, her love is visible. You can see it. If a non-Christian came to her doorway and saw the life she was leading and knew about her faith and even heard a proposition, a talk about giving something into that faith, right? An outsider, a non-Christian, if they saw that, they'd say, oh, that's a Christian. I like that. And it made me think of Jesus. I mean, who got mad at him and who liked him? When you ask that question, when you read the gospel next time, any one of them, ask yourself, who liked him and who did he like? And then who hated him and why? That's super revealing. And I got onto this reading because of Rose. I decided I'm going to go home and reread my Bible. Now, another thing happened. Before all these children came into her home in 1994, one little girl was brought to her bamboo hut. And that little girl was sleeping on her bamboo floor when my wife and I went to visit, about our third time we met. And we said, Rose, this little girl. Beautiful little girl, coconut oil massage into her hair, and she had just bathed in the Shoglo River, which incidentally is also everything else you need for water. It's their latrine, it's their cooking water, everything from this little stream. So she had just bathed, and she was beautiful, and she was wearing a hand-woven tunic that that tribe of people wear, the Korean tribe, white tunic. And I stole one note, who's the little girl? And she said that the child had just been brought to her a couple of days ago by pro-democracy soldiers who were sent to the village that she's from, and because they had a report that that village had been attacked by the Burma army. The soldiers got there. Of course, the village was destroyed, and they found one survivor. A lot of these people ran into the jungle and joined the 4 million other internally displaced people. But along with the carnage that was left in the wake of that event, one little girl was found, and they found her in a really great hiding place. They assumed that her loved ones were running with her while the village was being attacked. They hid her in this hiding place and said, shh, don't say a word. And the little girl was quiet for however many days it was before the good guys showed up, and the good guys found her. And they carried her a couple days back to the river, and they took her to Rose. And they said, Rose, will you be the foster mother to this child? Because we don't know, you know, if her parents survived or even if her parents were there. All we know is it's the only known survivor from that village. And when we heard that story, my wife and I heard that story, Rose invited us to get involved, to help start some kind of safety net for kids like that. And again, that was a conflict for me. Because do you remember what I said? I do the gospel, and the gospel is a series of propositions, invitations. I don't do this other stuff. I don't give money to poor people. I don't help street people. I don't do that kind of stuff. I don't give rice to starving refugees. I mean, it sounds comical to me now, because, like, hungry people, what's good news? It's a hamburger, right? In their case, it's rice. And so we calculated the total cost for that first little girl. It was $30 for a year. Everything that child needed to get on her feet. School fees, coins for the offering plate, food until she got on the roster with the international agencies that provided food for that camp. An extra tunic, towel for bathing, sandals for the rainy season so she doesn't get parasites through her feet. That's another way they get parasites. On and on, whole list of stuff, $30. And I was like, man, I can't say no to this. You know, as much insulation as I had packed around myself, I just couldn't say no. And I felt like Rose was Jesus looking up into my face saying, I'd like you to go on a whole new adventure with me. That's what I felt. My wife felt that too. So we committed $30, and then what happened is every time we went there were 5 more kids, 10 more kids, because the pro-democracy soldiers found out there was a safe place for them. And then they asked us to start more homes. We started, by 1998, we had 1,000 children in 12 homes and 8 refugee camps. So I went back and reread my Bible because I thought Rose had something I didn't have. And I was actually a pretty arrogant person. I had committed the first 3 chapters of Romans to memory, and I was going to memorize the whole book. I was the guy that fasted for 3 weeks, and I was planning on a month one, because then I would be so much better than you. I read the Bible 7 times cover to cover and kept track. Because, again, I was pretty committed to God liking me more than you. And I don't know how I went from being a born-again drug abuser, dysfunctional idiot, and these things being genuinely real to me, to it being all about me. I don't know how that happened. But it happened to me. And So when I reread the Bible, it kind of blew my mind. I ran into verses that I hadn't seen before in those seven times. Cover to cover. This little goes down the... Another only known survivor from our village is found sleeping in the slot of a pig pen. Don Mukamal, her name. I just got to tell you this story. It's so sweet. She was carried by the pro-democracy soldiers to Rose's place and didn't talk for a year. Peed on me every time she visited. Like she'd sit on my lap or my wife's lap and we'd be watching a presentation. Rose was into drama and they would do dramas and stuff. And like every time she peed on me, I don't know what it was about.
You relaxed.
I love you. But she became this wonderful, beautiful kid under the loving care of Rose. And she lived with Rose until Rose died, and then we put her in another of those homes in the camps. And about 2008, a man came to the refugee camp. He had been going from camp to camp. The story of his daughter that he left in a pig pen, hoping that the Vermonter would find her. And she had lived with us for like 12 years. Now she grew up as this beautiful little girl. And it was her dad. She went back to Burma with him. So I reread the Bible, and I was shocked at what I found, because a lot of my reading of Scripture and my studies had to do with anecdotal evidence for my debates or my theological projects in my head. It's all in my head. You know, grace versus works. That was a big one for me. I mean, I spent 10 years in Arminianism versus Calvinism, just going back and forth endlessly. And I saw these verses in the Bible as part of that debate. And the first verse that really shook me up was 1 John 3:16 to 18. And it says, "We know love because Jesus loved us and laid his life down for us, and that's what we should do for one another." And who of you, verse 17, who of you, if he sees someone who is poor, who lacks material provisions, and closes your heart against them, how can you say, God's love? And I have made a living out of closing my heart against the poor, and out of making the good news, which is the gospel, the good news of Jesus, I have made it into this narrow, defined set of propositions. I shut my heart against the poor for years. And the final verse is like a slap in the face. John says, let us not love with word or tongue, but let us love in action and in deed. When I read that, it's like, of course. I mean, it's the greatest command, right? You love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, strength. You love your neighbor as yourself. In fact, that is the broken record of all of John. In different ways, he's saying this over and over again. One without the other is a trivialization of love. One without the other is a trivialization of the life of Jesus. One without the other is making a mockery of the cross. The cross, Jesus went all the way. His actions were congruent with the love he expressed. He was not dealing in sentiment. He was dealing in relationships. He didn't objectify people. He talked to them with respect, with dignity, and he pulled them along into his own heart. I read that. Read it and look it up. In the Greek, it means what it says in English. I looked up all those words. And it's like, you can't read this stuff and not feel convicted and not feel somehow that there is something more to this good news than just telling people that Jesus loves them and has a plan for their life. If they would just pray, everything's going to get better. Or any variation of that sort, that message. So, Then I read James, which I was with many theologians who wonder why this is even in the canon of Scripture. And because it seems to be so oriented towards works and grace is like our big debate. You know, comes from Martin Luther, sola scriptura, right? You know, like this is our heritage. And of course Luther did what he did for good reason, but it's a battle that we've carried into every passage of the New Testament, and I think a lot of times it's completely unwarranted. The message of the New Testament is that people who follow Jesus do this stuff. That's what the message is. It's not, you know, even Matthew 25, where we hear that people are saved by, you know, setting the captives free, giving food to the hungry, giving water to the thirsty. You know, they're the sheep that go into eternal rest with God, right? You've read that, right? The whole point of that is just that people who follow Jesus do that. That's what they do. That whole list of stuff, that's what we are supposed to be known for. And when I read it, I read James again. And James, you know, James is the last one to accept Jesus as the Messiah. Why? Because I think it's because his brother. You know, he grew up and had diarrhea with him. And had, you know, watched Jesus having a crush on his third grade rabbi. Jesus is this fully alive human man, boy. He grew up with this other fully alive human boy that became a man, and I'd like to propose that James actually has a pretty sweet and deeply relational angle into who Jesus was because he grew up with him. And the key to understanding James is 127. What is true religion? What is true faith? What is good spiritual practice? It's caring for widows and orphans in their time of distress and keeping oneself pure. It's another reproduction of the greatest commandment. Remember with me, what's the greatest commandment? Like, it's the answer from the lawyer, how does one go to heaven? And the rich young ruler, how do you go to heaven? What's Jesus' answer? Love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. So this stuff started tumbling together for me. And I started realizing that I had somehow missed the plot. There's the greatest commandment. That little girl, her village was attacked in 2006. And from 2006 to when I visited her in 2008 in Myanmar, they had to run for their lives from the Myanmar army 12 times. They lost everything. When we got there, I'd been walking for 3 weeks when I got to that village. And I was starving. I was super hungry. We got there, and it was way past midnight. We'd been walking all day, and I was just completely wasted, tired, and hungry. Took the coldest shower in my life. It was gross to get in your bag and, you know, be all stinky. And the only thing they had to feed us, they had a little bit of rice left, but that morning they went and killed their dog. And made curry out of the dog food. And man, I tell you, that was the best tasting. I was so hungry. On that trip, we actually ate five dogs. But the dog the point is this beautiful child is living in a state of deprivation. What's the good news for her? Think about our own children how much we love them. What do we do for them? Think about our family and how we interact with them and how if we major on words, if we deal in words, we're burning bridges. So how do we live into these relationships so that we are good news? So Isaiah 58, the irony of building a temple to the God who set the Hebrews free from slavery with Hebrew slaves. And the Hebrew slaves, guess who it is? The widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. That's who's building the temple. They're rebuilding Jerusalem in Isaiah 58. And when I got that, and when I realized what was going on, and that this is not a passage about about fasting and casting demons out, because that's my early Pentecostal roots. That's how it was interpreted. I realized that it's not about that at all. It just unraveled me. So I started digging deeper. And I read a book by Tim Keller. Do you guys read him? Called A Generous Justice. Have any of you read that? That'll mess your head up. And I'm going to summarize it right here. The whole point of that book is that the dominant theme in the Old Testament and the dominant theme running into the New Testament has to do with justice. And I'm not a progressive liberal justice guy. Don't put the label on me. I'm just telling you what I've discovered. I reread the Bible, not just the New Testament, but the Old Testament, and I started looking up the occurrences of these words, especially after I read that book. And in the Bible, you often read that righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. You know that, like, that phrase? When righteousness and justice appear together, that's two words for justice. One is righteousness and justice, and one is a state of justice. Mishpat is one of those. It occurs 200 times in the Old Testament, and it has to do with treating people equitably. The other word is tzedakah, and that has to do with a state of justice. These two words hover around four categories of people through the whole Old Testament. Those categories are the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. To the degree that those people are cared for, to the degree that those people are safe and in a state of thriving, to that degree does God say just. To the degree that those people are cared for, to that degree does God say, you know and love me. I dare you read the Old Testament, the major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. They're all about this. They're all about the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. That's the acid test that God's people have departed from. These words occur so consistently that you can't miss it. And if you look at the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor, you'll find it. If you just bump in and start with Deuteronomy, you know, the book report on the Ten Commandments has to do with these people. And this is the distillation of which is in the life of Jesus. Love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's Deuteronomy 6:5, right? And he quotes Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself. This is a horrible story of a girl who was violated in the worst ways while her six-year-old brother watched. It was another, and one of the early orphans that we helped care for. Mom and dad were killed while they were working in their rice field. And again, she, when we were confronted with her story and invited to get involved with her, I asked the question, what is good news for this little girl? How does Jesus approach this child? How does he show this little girl love? Another story like that. Okay, so in the drive-by panorama of the Bible, that especially Tim Keller gets into the New Testament and how the New Testament uses the word diakosune, which is very similar to the word mishpat in the Old Testament. It's justice. It's not penal justice, it's restorative justice. He says, Tim Keller, and actually a number of other academic sources say, 300 years before Jesus, Plato wrote a book about this word. He used this word in the Just Republic. And so the hearers of Jesus' talks, especially the Sermon on the Mount, they would understand when he used this word, they would understand it to mean what? Justice. But what the word that we read. And blessed are the what? Do you remember? In the Beatitudes, it says, blessed are the righteous. Over and over again. And I don't think there's one translation of the Bible that uses justice once in the New Testament, and that is the Catholic translation that I can't remember. Oh, Jerusalem Bible. That's the only translation. All of the other English Bibles prefer the word righteousness, and there is some good reason for that. But when you hear the word righteousness, what do you hear? How does your mind respond or your heart respond to that word? But it says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. I always thought that meant righteousness that I have received from others and righteous behavior that I correspondingly act on. Moral rectitude. Is that something similar to what you understood? But that's not at all what's being said. And to the tune of 92 times in the New Testament, it's this Greek word. And that Greek word means justice that is profoundly social. Now, your politics react to that, take it up with God, because it's his book. I didn't write it. That's what it says. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of justice, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So I read this stuff, and I didn't know what to do with it. I felt, well, the reading just humiliated me and helped me understand why Rose was an attractive force and I was a missionary with no non-Christian friends. And I don't, you know, I wouldn't want to be my friend. I was all about, like, getting you saved all the time. It was my only, like, I was one track record. One string guitar, always. Every interaction. I couldn't enjoy a relationship without objectifying people into this notion of evangelism. Should we be leading people to Christ? Absolutely. He's changed us. He's our hope, right? Our words are a small piece of that. I know you've all experienced this, because in real relationships, people respond to your kindness. They don't generally respond to feeling manipulated or objectified. But people also respond to your words. And words. Billy Graham is a great example of that. A word spoken in the right moment can be transforming and set one on this course to death and beauty. It can be good news. But good news doesn't just... It's not just words. And my experience when I stopped thinking in that way was that all of a sudden I started having non-Christian friends and they started wanting to talk about faith with me. They initiated. With the Muslims that we work with in Myanmar, the Rohingya people, I mean, we countless times now they come to us and say, what is your story? Why do you keep, we know you're Christians. Why do you keep caring about us? I've been working with them since 2012, and we've attempted and have succeeded in keeping 75,000 out of 150,000 people alive. And they say, well, why are you doing this? You're Christians. I mean, they just have this weird idea about Christianity, that all that Christian missionaries care about is for them to convert. And they think, we've had their leaders come to us and say, what is it about you people? And what do we say? We say we are deeply in love with the author of love. He cares about you. And we're not just here because we think you need to be converted. We're here because your suffering registers and matters to us. What is happening to your children that you can't, that your kids haven't gone to school in 5 years, that matters to us. That there's no health care for 150,000 people, it matters. And when we step into that space as good news, almost without exception, people ask us, what is the deal? Where is this coming from? Why do you care about me? Why do you love me? And I think that's part of the point of Matthew 25, the sheep and the goats. It's an irresistible force. Real love, when we act on love, when our words, our sentiment, and our actions are the same, we are a magnetic and unstoppable force in the world. And it doesn't matter if you're downtown Mount Vernon, or you are on a battlefield in Syria, or you're in a food delivery system in Yemen. It's all the same. Love is an irresistible magnetic force that everyone wants. And it's on us to figure out how to make that love something that people can relate to, something that people can understand. And in the context of dignity, respect, love, these are not lost, you know, lost and uninformed people. These are image bearers of God. They are part of our family. And what? How do we reach them? Well, clearly we don't reach them the way I used to do it. So my team and I, we work where politics and violence prevents children from having food and having basic essentials that they need. And the places that I mentioned, Myanmar and the surrounding countries, and then northern Iraq and Syria and Yemen, those are the places where we work. 65 team members, and what we're attempting to do is live this stuff, just like you. And our context is challenging, just like yours, because helping street people has its own particular set of problems, wisdoms, unintended consequences. There's a whole craft to how to help these people. The only way to help them, though, is through relationship. Bend down and become friends. That's it. That's the starting point. And that's the starting point for everybody.